and VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The U.S. has sent Israel a letter warning it risks losing American weapons funding unless it allows far more humanitarian aid into Gaza. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The letter was not meant as a threat,
but rather White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says it was meant to reiterate a sense of U.S. urgency
about the need for an increase, a dramatic increase in humanitarian assistance.
The U.S. is giving Israel 30 days to, among other things, speed the aid flow, which had ramped up after a similar letter in April. But State Department spokesman Matthew Miller says the flow has dropped sharply.
By over 50% from where it was at its peak.
The letter comes amid growing U.S. frustration as Israel has defied repeated requests to scale back operations against Hamas. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump is refusing to say whether he's spoken with Russian President Vladimir Putin since Trump left the White House.
Well, I don't comment on that, but I will tell you that if I did, it's a smart thing. If I'm friendly with people, if I have a relationship with people, that's a good thing, not a bad thing, in terms of a country.
The Republican presidential candidate Tuesday was pressed on his communication with the Russian president during a wide-ranging and sometimes contentious interview at the Economic Club of Chicago. Trump touted his relationship with Putin, as well as the authoritarian leaders of North Korea and China.
I had a very good relationship with President Xi, and a very good relationship with Putin, and a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, who has a nuclear force that you won't even believe.
Journalist Bob Woodward reports in his new book, Trump had as many as 7 private phone calls with Putin since leaving office. This is VOA News. An independent commission in Bangladesh, formed after the August ouster of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, is investigating enforced disappearances during her rule. VOA's Sarah Zaman reports from the capital, Dhaka.
Rights groups say over 700 people, mostly political opponents and rights activists, went missing during Hasina's last 15 years in office. Aisha Ali's son, Abdul Qadir Bhuiya Masoom, has been missing since December 2013.
I keep waiting for my son to call me Ma once again, for him to say, Mother, how are you?
Bangladesh's interim government formed a 5-member commission to investigate cases of enforced disappearances. Ali hopes it will help her find her son. Working behind closed doors, the commission is a ray of hope for many, but the pace of its work is frustrating to some. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Dhaka.
Floods have brought devastation to parts of West and Central Africa over the past several months. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has more.
Over the last few months, heavy rains have flooded every one of Chad's 23 provinces. In northern Nigeria, a dam burst with devastating consequences. Ancient buildings have been damaged in Niger's desert town, Agadez. And amid that destruction, the human cost. More than 1,460 people dead, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Usman Tijani Sugi is the Director of Meteorological Observations and Forecasting at Chad's National Meteorological Agency.
Houses have collapsed, bridges have given way, roads have completely been destroyed, and vehicles have been swept away, especially in the northern regions.
According to a 2021 study in the Journal of Hydrology, the Sahel region is increasingly threatened by floods. The study described widespread havoc and devastation as becoming commonplace.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. Florida residents hard hit by Hurricane Milton are getting back on their feet. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In the wake of Hurricane Milton, some Florida areas continue flooding because of cresting rivers. Meanwhile, recovery work continues. Governor Ron DeSantis says the state's disaster fund has raised about $12 million and counting.
Through the disaster fund, we've been able to cut red tape and we've been able to get assistance to people who need it.
He also says power is back for most of the state.
You're even without power for a few hours, it could be a real pain in the rear end, but we had over 50,000 linemen. These folks really got to work.
And free gas is still available at 10 state depots. I'm Julie Walker.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
U.S. has strong words for Israel.
The secretary, along with Secretary Austin, thought it was appropriate to make clear to the government of Israel that there are changes that they need to make again.
Are North Korean soldiers fighting for Russia in Ukraine?
Ukrainian and South Korean officials say North Koreans were reportedly among those killed after a Ukrainian missile strike in the Russian-occupied Donetsk region last week.
Plus, the conversation with imprisoned pro-democracy publisher Ginny Lai's son.
My goal is to release him as soon as possible because at his age he could die at any moment.
Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish.
We begin today again in the Middle East.
Israel is continuing its clampdown on northern Gaza. They maintain they're going after Hamas fighters and infrastructure, but conditions are getting worse for everyone. Fiona Jones of Reuters has the story.
Israeli strikes in Gaza killed tens of Palestinians on Tuesday, local authorities said. That's as Israel's forces tightened their siege around Jabalia in the north of the enclave, amid fierce battles with Hamas-led fighters. Palestinian health officials said over 10 people had died in a fire near Al-Fallujah in Jabalia, the largest of Gaza's 8 historic refugee camps. Several were reported killed after a strike on Nusayrat's camp. Missiles also reportedly hit houses in Khan Yunis and Gaza City. Zarifa Abu Tamia, whose house was hit in Khan Yunis, mourned her cousin Mona.
They didn't give us any warning. We were sleeping, all of us, and no one was awake. I only woke up when people woke me up and said, "You are alive." I was in the same place I was. I started searching for Mona because she was in the same room with me. I started looking for her but couldn't find her.
Jabalia has been the focus of an Israeli offensive for more than 10 days. Israel's military has now encircled the camp there and sent tanks to nearby towns. They've said their aim is to stamp out Hamas fighters who are trying to regroup there and have told residents to evacuate. But the UN said the military appear to be, quote, cutting off North Gaza completely from the rest of the Gaza Strip. Israel launched the offensive against Hamas after the militant group's October 7th cross-border attack, in which, according to Israeli tallies, 1,200 people were killed. Gaza's health authorities say over 42,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's retaliatory offensive.
That's Reuters' Fiona Jones reporting for us.
The United States has sent a letter to Israel demanding it facilitate an immediate surge in humanitarian assistance into Gaza. The letter, which the Pentagon said was intended to remain private, comes as a U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Battery, or THAAD, has started to arrive in Israel to defend against future attacks. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
With the humanitarian situation in Gaza worsening, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin sent a letter to their Israeli counterparts calling for concrete commitments to improve the humanitarian situation within 30 days. A failure to do so, they say, could have, quote, implications for U.S. policy. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
The Secretary, along with Secretary Austin, thought it was appropriate to make clear to the government of Israel that there are changes that they need to make again to see that the level of assistance making it into Gaza comes back up from the very, very low levels that it is at today.
According to the U.S., a similar request was sent to Israel in April that led to increased humanitarian assistance into Gaza. But that assistance is now down by more than 50% from what it was at its peak. Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
The land routes are the most effective way to get aid flowing to the civilians that need it most. So, of course, we want to see those corridors open up. That's something that the secretary continues to emphasize in his calls.
The administration declining this week to discuss what would happen should Israel fail to meet the letter's demands.
Is the U.S. military debating right now whether or not to withhold military support to Israel?
Israel continues to receive support from the United States, whether it be through FMS sales or what you're seeing, you know, that we're doing in Israel self-defense. I just don't have more to provide.
A U.S. THAAD battery, along with dozens of American troops to operate it, began arriving in Israel this week. Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh.
You've seen our destroyers engage from the sea. This is now a land-based capability that will be able to help defend against another ballistic missile attack if Iran did choose to respond in that way.
Iran has launched two direct attacks against Israel, with Iran most recently firing about 200 ballistic missiles toward the country. Tel Aviv has not yet responded to the latest attack. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Changing gears now, we go to Russia's war in Europe. Kyiv accused Pyongyang of deeper involvement in the Russia-Ukraine war when news emerged of North Korean soldiers allegedly being present in occupied territories of Ukraine. Ukrainian and South Korean officials also say some North Koreans were killed in a recent Ukrainian missile strike. Anna Chernikova has the story from Kyiv.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in his Sunday evening address, said North Korean troops have been deployed to fight for Russia in Ukraine. He called on Ukrainian allies to provide Ukraine with more weapons and assistance, considering the new circumstances. Zelensky says Ukraine sees an increasing alliance between Russia and regimes like North Korea, and it's no longer just about transferring weapons. It is actually about transferring people from North Korea to the occupying military forces. On Monday, Zelensky held a meeting with top military and intelligence officials to discuss the developments. Moscow has denied reports of North Korean troops being sent to help Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the reports fake news. Last week, South Korea's defense minister Kim Yong-hyun said it was highly likely that North Korean troops were being deployed to help Russia. Previously, North Korean missiles were confirmed to have been used in Ukraine after the examination of the missiles that hit the capital, Kyiv, a couple of months ago. Political analyst Mykola Davydyuk told VOA that Russia is trying to demonstrate that it is ready for any escalation in the conflict and that its allies will provide needed support without hesitation. Ukrainian and South Korean officials say North Koreans were reportedly among those killed after a Ukrainian missile strike in the Russian-occupied Donetsk region last week. In June, Russian President Vladimir Putin traveled to Pyongyang, where both sides pledged closer cooperation and signed a treaty containing a mutual defense clause. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Looking now at press freedom around the world and a conversation with the son of imprisoned publisher Jimmy Lai. On the sidelines of a democracy conference in Prague this week, former Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen called for Jimmy Lai's release from jail in Hong Kong. VOA's Liam Scott reports from Prague.
Taiwan is playing an important role in defending democracy amid the global rise of authoritarianism. Former Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen said during a speech Monday at the Forum 2000 Democracy Conference in Prague. Following her speech, she took a moment to speak with VOA about Jimmy Lai, the pro-democracy publisher jailed in Hong Kong on charges widely viewed as bogus. Tsai told VOA she believes Hong Kong should release him. Jimmy Lai's son Sebastian was also at Forum 2000. He told VOA that now is a critical time for his jailed father because the national security trial is set to resume in a few weeks.
My goal is to release him as soon as possible because at his age he could die at any moment.
Jimmy Lai is a British national. Sebastian said he hopes British Foreign Minister David Lammy will raise his father's case with the Chinese government during his trip to China next week.
In the end of the day, this is about saving my father's life. And the Foreign Secretary is in a unique position to do that.
In an email to VOA, a Hong Kong government spokesperson denied that rule of law has declined. The spokesperson also pushed back against international criticism of Lai's trial and rejected reports that Lai isn't receiving adequate medical care. Lai's international legal team is concerned that the trial could face additional delays. Jonathan Price is a member of that legal team.
It doesn't seem to us like he's finished anytime soon.
Lai is expected to take the stand for the first time when his trial resumes on November 20th. Liam Scott, VOA News, Prague.
And here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world.
The head of Myanmar's military government has invited ethnic rebels to hold peace talks to end armed conflict across the country. It's the second time in less than a month that the ruling generals have publicly promoted negotiations.
A Russian man has been rescued after surviving 2 months at sea in an inflatable boat after his engine lost power while on a whale-watching trip. His brother and nephew, also on board, have died. He was rescued Monday by a fishing vessel off the Kamchatka Peninsula.
On Tuesday, Mexico's new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, acknowledged that three civilians, including a child, died in two separate shootouts involving the military last week in Nuevo Laredo, across the border from Laredo, Texas. She gave no sign of backing away from the outsized role that she and her predecessor have given to the armed forces. She added that the events on Friday and Saturday are under investigation. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Time now for a look at the American presidential election. In the U.S., all eyes are on the seven so-called battleground states that are expected to determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential contest. While some of them have shifted politically over the years, the western state of Nevada does not lean strongly toward one major party or the other. VOA's Dora Mercois reports from Las Vegas.
Nevada, home to 3.1 million people, is probably best known for Las Vegas, its most famous city, also known as Sin City.
But they're a bit of a paradox. I mean, they're seen as perhaps a liberal state in some sense because it was the first state that really pushed no-fault divorce. It has gambling in certain counties, allows prostitution. But it also has this undercurrent of being very, very conservative in some respects.
Nevada reliably voted Republican from the late 1960s until the early 2000s. Since then, the state regularly swings between the two political parties. Nevada's population has more than tripled since 1980. Many recent newcomers are from predominantly liberal California.
What's happened is the Clark County, which is the county where Las Vegas sits, is now 72% of the voting population in this state. So what has happened to Nevada is what was once a rural Mountain West state has become an urban West Coast state.
There's Vegas, and then there's the rest of Nevada. And from my knowledge, Vegas tends to be more on the Democrat side, whereas the rest of Nevada is more Republican. But then again, most of the population is in Vegas.
Despite the population explosion, Nevada remains heavily working class, with many residents working manual jobs.
So things like wages, things like unemployment, things like housing affordability, just inflation in general, so things like fuel prices, all of those things affect people a little bit more here in Nevada than they might some other states.
College students at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas outline their top issues. Some will vote for the first time now that they've reached the voting age of 18.
Definitely abortion, definitely the economy. What else? Education as well.
The state of economy, probably just the border.
I'm kind of broke college kid. I would just like to be able to better afford food. I would like to be able to have a single job that pays enough to help me with all of my needs.
When they vote in November's general election, Nevadans will also vote on whether to install a right to abortion in the state constitution.
The issue overall has already proven to be a big driver, a big motivator of turnout in prior elections, and I think this one will be no different.
Still, Miller says no one should underestimate former President Donald Trump's chances of winning Nevada.
I think that Trump is being perceived as a candidate unlikely to win Nevada simply because he hasn't won the last two times. I wouldn't discount the importance of economic issues as driving the decision for voters in this state.
Nevada's critical role as a battleground state is why both presidential nominees, Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, are spending time here. Because ultimately, what happens in Vegas could determine who will lead America for the next 4 years.
You're fired. Get out of here. You're fired.
Dora McClure, VOA News, Las Vegas.
As the United States is in the throes of yet another presidential election cycle, both tickets offer largely contrasting positions for America's position on the international stage. However, must America's approach to its role on the international stage be one of two extremes, or can it be more nuanced? Steve spoke with Karishma Mehta, an analyst at the RAND Corporation.
Your article begins, you're saying the United States needs a dynamic approach to its foreign policy. What does that mean?
It means that it needs to think about nuanced approaches towards its
allies and partners where they are empowered, but at the same time, the U.S. Achieves its goals and is able to achieve it in a way where it's cost-effective, it's manageable, and it doesn't put as much stress or undue stress on the U.S.
Isn't that what's happening now? I mean, I would imagine that's what people are trying to do.
I would say yes, people are trying to do that. But as you know, defense spending is always a topic of conversation. And it seems like we're stretched very thin. So, in a dynamic foreign policy approach would allow us to maybe rely on our allies a little bit more, work with them a little bit more, and to really look at the trade-offs between like control and cost that achieves a certain level of effectiveness, whereas if we were in the driver's seat, it achieves a certain level of effectiveness. Maybe if we're in the passenger seat, it achieves another level of effectiveness that is still within our measure of success.
Now, you said working with our allies. That sounds like something that Kamala Harris might say. You said letting our allies take control a little bit more. That sounds like something Donald Trump might say. How do each of the campaigns differ in their approach to what you call this dynamic foreign policy?
So I don't want to speak for either party.
As an observer, looking at them.
So I think Donald Trump's rhetoric is very much of this retrenchment policy that we've seen throughout American history, and Kamala Harris's is of internationalism, which we've also seen throughout American history. Now, what we're arguing, my co-author and I, Hunter Stoll, is that extremes of either policy would be costly to the U.S. An extreme of retrenchment would pull us out of organizations and that we pioneered, such as NATO, whereas internationalism would be costly to us monetarily.
So you're advocating for the Goldilocks approach, right? Something just right, a little mix of both.
Yeah, that's correct.
And how does that happen? How do you make that happen?
Well, we make that happen by talking to each other, by understanding what we want to achieve both internally and with our allies and partners. For a particular problem, we have to acknowledge that there's going to be a trade-off, right? If we're in charge for X situation and we have to let our allies and partners be in charge of Y situation, then we have to trust that our allies and partners will do that by having open dialogues with them, being able to share intel with them in an appropriate way. And that's something that policymakers need to decide what America's equation for that is, right? I don't want to speak for our policymakers in saying, like, with country X, we'll be doing this, and with country Y, we'll be doing that. That's what they have to decide, and along with that country.
Karishma Mehta is an analyst with the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Karishma, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you so much.
Steve Karish speaking with the RAND Corporation's Karishma Mehta.
Turkey is deepening its cooperation with Somalia, this month sending a research ship to look for energy resources. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia are threatening Ankara's ambitions in the Horn of Africa.
Turkey's research ship Oruç Reis, escorted by Turkish warships, set sail this month from Istanbul to Somalia to search for what are widely believed to be vast energy reserves. The deployment is part of an energy and security agreement between Turkey and Somalia in what analysts say is an accelerating relationship. But they say growing regional tensions could threaten Ankara's aspirations. That is a warning from geopolitical consultant Norman Rickliffs.
Turkey needs Somalia and Ethiopia to play well together. So this is vitally important for Turkish regional ambitions.
Tensions have been rising since January when Ethiopia signed a memorandum of understanding with Somaliland, a region that has unilaterally declared independence from Somalia. Under the agreement, Ethiopia would secure sea access in exchange for recognizing the breakaway state. Somalia condemns the deal, accusing Ethiopia of infringing on its territorial integrity. Turkey is mediating the conflict, but the dispute is broadening after Egypt started shipping arms to Somalia. Elem Irije Tepecioglu is an African studies professor at the Social Sciences University of Ankara.
Somalia's growing ties with Egypt can provide Somalia leverage to negotiate with Ethiopia on more favorable terms. So it could strengthen Somalia's bargaining power in its negotiations with Ethiopia. So if Egypt deepens its security ties with Somalia, Ethiopia might perceive it as a direct security threat. So this might increase the mistrust during the talks.
Egypt is at odds with Ethiopia over its damming of the Nile River. The tensions also threaten Somalia and Ethiopia's military collaboration against the al-Qaeda-linked group al-Shabaab. Analysts say that while Ankara is still well-placed to resolve the tensions because of its good ties with all parties, it needs diplomatic support. Omar Mahmoud, senior Eastern Africa analyst for the International Crisis Group.
Turkey still should be, can still be the lead mediator, but outside actors like the U.S., like the EU, like those in the Gulf, adding their weight to that to say, okay, look, this has gone on for quite some time. The longer this goes on, the greater the risk of miscommunication and miscalculation and some sort of conflictual outcome.
With Ankara investing heavily in Somalia militarily and diplomatically, analysts warn that any new conflict or even deepening instability in the war-torn region would threaten Turkey's goal of widening its influence. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And finally, Wednesday, October 16th is World Food Day. Aid agencies are warning that conflict and climate change are increasing hunger and malnutrition across much of Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations reports around 733 million people, or 1 in 11 people, are going hungry because of conflicts, climate change, and economic downturn. Among this number are more than 6 million people across the Lake Chad region, the highest number in the past 4 years. Yan Bonzon is head of delegation for Nigeria for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Speaking on a video link from Nigeria, he says the consequences of armed conflict in the Lake Chad region, compounded by climate change, continue killing people, especially young children, who are the most vulnerable.
Every day, doctors and nurses in health facilities we support in northeast Nigeria receive and treat severely malnourished kids. Desperate mothers tell us every day how healthy children become weak and fall sick, and how putting food on the table has turned into a daily struggle.
Bonzon says the number of children treated for severe malnutrition in ICRC health facilities in northeast Nigeria has increased by 24% over the past year. A similarly distressing scenario is playing out in southern Africa. The United Nations warns a widespread drought in the region triggered by an El Nino weather pattern could turn into a full-scale humanitarian catastrophe without international assistance. The World Food Program says this historic drought has devastated more than 27 million lives across the region. WFP spokesperson for Southern Africa, Thompson Theory, says some 21 million children are malnourished.
October in Southern Africa marks the start of the lean season, and each month is expected to be worse than the previous one until harvest next year in March and April.
The UN's Food Agency says international humanitarian support is desperately needed. Unfortunately, it says it has received only one-fifth of the $369 million needed to provide life-saving assistance to millions in southern Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for listening.